Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Squawker Talker preview of both the Champions League and Europa League finals. This special episode is brought to you by our sponsors, William Hill. And don't forget, you can download the William Hill sports betting app to put the world of betting at your fingertips. That's available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. You must be over 18 to download it, and please gamble responsibly. All odds mentioned during the podcast were correct at the time of recording. Right then, the end of the season brings about two major European showpiece finals, and it's set to be an all Premier League affair in Portugal as treble-chasing Manchester City take on Thomas Tuchel's Chelsea. That's in the Champions League final. Pep Guardiola's side obviously looking to secure their first ever Champions League. With Chelsea, they're aiming to bounce back from that defeat in the FA Cup final to Leicester City. We'll be taking an inside look at some of the key battles that are expected in that one as Kevin De Bruyne and N'Golo Kante go head to head in midfield. There's also an intriguing battle emerging with an England edge. Teammates Phil Foden and Mason Mount will also face off, and that's all to come in part one. And then in part two, we turn our attentions to Gdansk and the Europa League final. Manchester United boss Ole Gunnar Solskjaer aiming to secure his first title as the boss man at Old Trafford, and they find themselves up against La Liga side Villarreal and the serial Europa League winner that is Unai Emery. Right then, my name's Fergal Brennan, and joining me we have Squawker regulars, the Kingpins, Mohamed Butt and Harry Edwards. Mo, we're going to go to you first on this. Two massive finals coming up in the next few weeks. Are you excited?
I'm very excited, Fergal. Yeah, mate.
Harry, two big games. Gdansk and Porto are going to be the host. We now know they're confirmed, as it? Three Premier League teams involved. It was almost an all-Premier League setup, despite Arsenal losing to Villarreal. But it's set to be a really exciting end to the season, and it's still quite difficult to call how it's going to end up.
Yeah, and it's good to see, you know, a throwback to 10, 15 years ago where England were dominating the final stages of the Champions League, certainly. So it's good to see the Premier League back up there. And like you said, we've got, you know, four teams, you know, any two of them can win it.
Continuing the theme with you guys, you two are both nice guys. Kingpins, we called you at the start, but really you're nice guys. That's what I'd use to describe you. And one of football's nicest guys is going to be on display in the Champions League final, N'Golo Kante. I don't know any football fan, any Premier League fan, any part-time football fan that even takes a fleeting interest in football that does not love N'Golo Kante. Everything he does on the pitch, off the pitch, he seems like the most pleasant fella to be around. And Paul Pogba, who's his international teammate for France, came up with a fantastic quote. He said, "The most beloved soccer player in history, it has to be N'Golo." Now, obviously, he's well-placed to him. He's friends and teammates with him for Didier Deschamps' side. But he's so well-respected that during the FA Cup final, there was a brilliant moment when Ben Chilwell was subbed on for Chelsea and everything he did was booed. N'Golo Kante played the full 90 minutes and the Leicester fans had nothing but praise for him. Mo, football needs a few nice guys. Is Kante the nicest guy in football?
If it's not him, he's either one or two, right? There's no one. It's only Juan Mata that's anywhere near Kante's level. Like, you look at the absolute nicest guys in football. Sadio Mane is getting up there. I think he's a very, very lovely person as well. But Kante is just an overwhelming generosity of spirit. He plays, and unlike Mata, he plays defensive midfield. So it's almost even easier to appreciate how nice he is because he doesn't even play in a role that really provides glory. You know, he plays in a role where he's like you're the unsung role. He's just there to provide energy for everyone else. He's so wonderful. Like, honestly, that you just look and you look at. I just remember going back to the World Cup when France won, and they had that song about how he was better than Messi, or he beat Messi, where it was, and like his face when they'd sing it, he was so embarrassed by that. It's like, you're so good. How are you so absurd? Like, comedically humble, almost. Like, he's like the ideal like humble superstar. But Mata, I would argue, is just as lovely, just as humble, just as selfless and giving to his teammates. Started the Common Goal initiative where footballers donate 1% of their salary. That's fantastic. So I think Mata is the only rival. No one else comes even close, I think.
Oh, Harry, we're going to continue the Kante loving, looking ahead to the game, because one of the big subplots before the final is his journey to it and alongside Riyad Mahrez. And their paths were joined for a time. They've obviously gone their separate ways, Kante at Chelsea and Riyad Mahrez at City. But this journey that's brought them to the biggest game in European football has started in fairly humble beginnings in the second division in France. Obviously, they were both part of that incredible title-winning story at Leicester City. Kante moved on immediately after that and joined Chelsea, and Mahrez a little bit later heading to the Etihad. Both of them have had this massive domestic success winning the Premier League title, but neither of them have won a Champions League. And it almost seems like destiny that they have to meet again in this final. And we all look forward to subplots and the little stories ahead of major finals. This is as good as it gets.
Yeah, like you said, they've both been on very similar journeys. And I think, obviously, like we've already mentioned, everybody loves N'Golo Kante. I think people are starting to appreciate Riyad Mahrez more. He doesn't have the nice guy, aura that N'Golo Kante has, but I think people are appreciating what he can do for Man City. And it has been, it's been a long and tough journey for him. Again, Kante moved straight to Chelsea after winning the league with Leicester. Mahrez stayed there for a bit longer. And, I think Mahrez can be a bit underappreciated by those outside Man City because he had the slow start at City. Statistically, slow start. He wasn't bringing the same numbers in his first season at Man City that as he did in the title-winning season at Leicester. And obviously, Pep Guardiola with his rotations, Mahrez, any other player can score, two, three goals in five games. And just because that's how Guardiola's got to fit in his team, they're out. So I think, it's, like I said, very, very similar journeys. Kante, he's probably the reason this Chelsea side are where they are. And then the same could be said about Mahrez. His record in the knockout stages to get City here. One of them's got to do it. But the question is who?
Yeah, I mean, you look at Mahrez, these are both big game players, right? Like Kante obviously won a World Cup. Mahrez won an African Cup of Nations for Algeria, scored in the final. But then you look at them this season, obviously they've been performing distantly. Kante just devoured the entire Real Madrid midfield. The same Madrid midfield who had their sort of renaissance against Liverpool, you're thinking, oh, maybe they're not a bunch of old guys. They really did a number on Liverpool. Toni Kroos in particular, his passing was outrageous. Those guys didn't get a second to breathe against Chelsea. Kante was just all over them. And more than just being all over them, he was then driving the ball into the final third, laying it off. He was like, it was almost impossible. When I was covering the games, it was impossible for me to write about it as in he was a normal human being. It was like, this is like Roy Keane in Turin twice, within the space of a week. It was ridiculous what he was doing. And it was just, this guy is amazing. And he's so humble with it. Riyad Mahrez, though, again, he was the decisive figure in the semi-final win over PSG. Three goals. If anyone else had scored three goals in the Champions League semi-final, we'd be like going, oh, like literally only one player in history has scored more goals in every single two-legged Champions League semi-final. It was Lewandowski against Real Madrid. And he scored four goals in one game. No one has scored more goals over a single two-legged Champions League final than Riyad Mahrez, except for Lewandowski. That's how good he was. That's how decisive he was. And okay, fine. The wall for his free kick was, we could charitably be described as existing. It was like Schrodinger's wall. But, he was still brilliant. He was constantly making runs. He was providing the threat. And this is what Riyad Mahrez does that I think that is unsung. And obviously, in his first season, he did struggle to adapt to Pep's system. His defining input to that year was missing the penalty against Liverpool, skying it over the bar. And you're thinking, oh, goodness me, Riyad. What's going on here? But he's grown and grown. He's grown into the system. And it reminds me almost of Eric Abidal, the way he was at Barcelona when Pep Guardiola took over. Eric Abidal, for the first year, 2 years under Pep, was not very good. Didn't seem to get it. Looked kind of lost. You're thinking, Pep was playing Milito at left back, Puyol at left back, Maxwell. He wasn't. But then in the third year, suddenly Abidal just turned like a light switch. It turns on, and he then suddenly literally became one of Barcelona's best players. And I think the same thing has happened to Mahrez. The first year he didn't get it at all; he was struggling. Second year he's really improved. This year he's just been flipping outrageous. He's been so good. It's like it's whenever he plays, you're like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. He's been so good that it's like there's no room for Raheem Sterling in the lineup. Now, I know everyone says that Foden has benched Sterling, and we'll get more into that later, but you know, you would think, oh, Foden's, we've got to play Foden, but then you can play Sterling on the right like he used to when Sane was bursting through. But there's no room for him because Mahrez is so lights out on the right. You can't play him there. It's like, this is how good Mahrez has been, and he's just so consistent and he's so decisive.
When we look at some of the big stories, obviously Kante Mahrez is something that gets so much focus, but Harry, Sergio Aguero is bringing down the curtain on his Man City career this summer. We now know that he's not going to sign a new contract. He's going to leave after 10 years, and the Champions League is the one trophy that he hasn't got his hands on. And the famous quote has been doing the rounds in the last few weeks that he said he wouldn't leave Manchester City until he'd won the Champions League. And now he's never going to have another chance, and he's never going to have a better chance to do just that. And it almost seems set up for a bit of a fairy tale end for him. He's played a bit part role this season, as Mo mentioned. Pep Guardiola's used different players and looked to use a different attacking system, and that meant that Aguero's probably lost out. But his record stands up to anybody. He's tied with Didier Drogba for the most Champions League goals for an English club, 36. A nice goal in the final would tip him over. And when you look at the situation that City have found themselves in, they've been so geared to winning the Champions League, and Aguero has been such a key part of that throughout all of these years. If you believe in any sort of magic being left in football, you believe in Aguero scoring.
Yeah, and you mentioned Drogba there. You only need to look at the 2012 final when it was Drogba who scored the equaliser for Chelsea against Bayern, who scored the equaliser for Chelsea. And then scored the winning penalty as well. Although his departure wasn't confirmed at the time, I think Chelsea fans had, you know, they'd prepared themselves for Drogba leaving that summer. So this was all, you know, his final kick of the ball. Forget that he came back a couple of years later, but you know, at that time, it was the story. And you know, in the build-up to that final, it was Drogba who got Chelsea through key moments. And although Aguero hasn't, like you've already said, you know, he's been a bit part player this season because there are better players, but also he's been, you know, struggling with the injuries. But anyone, you know, people always talk about football, you write a script, you know, it all signs off the pitch point to Aguero doing something. You know, he loves playing against Chelsea. Again, another, you know, a thorn in Chelsea's side, given the fact that they basically picked Drogba over Aguero when they had the chance to sign Aguero in the 2010-2011.
Yeah, he was begging Chelsea to sign him, wasn't he, at the time? And they were like, nah, we'll stick with Didier. And yeah, he scored 15 goals against Chelsea. That's more than level with Newcastle for the club he scored the most against as a player. You know, so admittedly, two of those came for Atletico Madrid, not all for Man City, but 15 goals in, what is it, 22 games. That's pretty healthy, right? Like, that's pretty healthy. Although the last of those was in 2019, I think, so in the 6-0 win. So let's see. But look, like Harry says, it's a fairy tale thing, right? Like, this guy, he's been a legendary striker, the best striker in the history of Man City. You know, 10 years ago was Aguero. Well, 9 years ago was the legendary when he won the league title for them with that last minute goal. He's been immense. He probably gave them their first sort of iconic Champions League moment when he scored that hat-trick against Bayern Munich, which could have sent them through, but then didn't because Pellegrini didn't underscore or whatever that thing was. So, you know, he's been a big figure, but in this season, he's barely played, right? He's been mostly on the bench, sitting around, whether through injury or just not selection. Pep hasn't been playing. He's been going strikerless. Again, more on that later. And it's interesting to see. Like, we all want it to be a romantic ending, but would he even get on the pitch? That's what I'm thinking. He's not going to start. We can almost guarantee he's not going to start. Right. The question then becomes, is he going to come on? And again, I would also probably say no, like, unless it's really desperate and like Chelsea are winning 1-0 and there's like 5 minutes left, then Pep might be like, all right, go on, Sergio, like, get on. But unless it's that, or unless City are winning like 3-0 and there's 5 minutes left, basically he's only playing for like 5-10 minutes maximum at the end of the game. if either City are way ahead and like just cruising and having a laugh, or if they need a goal basically, and he's like, oh, I'm getting desperate now, I may as well send you on. Because the way City have been set up this year, they don't need a striker. They don't want a striker. That's not how, you know, I mean, they can play that way. We saw against Crystal Palace, he can still go. He can still score when he plays, right? But City, the main 11, don't play that way anymore. At least not this season. And so it's going to be funny because Guardiola is often talked about being a football romantic, but this is, you know, he's completely anti-romance. He's like killing romance. He's like, nah, mate, you know, go away, Sergio. No, this is my team. This is my team. You're going to bet. You can come for 5 minutes. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. You know, but he's done, you know, he's done four, like in the 2011 final, Carlos Puyol, obviously Barca captain, the last time Pep was in a Champions League final. He was obviously injured. He'd been injured all season, had injury problems, kind of like Aguero this season, was still a totemic figure in the locker room. And Guardiola brought him on for the last 5 minutes for Eric, you know, right at the very end, just to bring him on when Barca were already 3-1 up. So again, if City can get into a comfortable position and be 3-1 up, yeah, we'll see Aguero come on and it'll be lovely and fans will cry and he might cry, maybe not either. Unless it's that situation, he probably won't even play. It's you know, Pep is anti-narrative. He's anti-narrativing us.
Harry, when you look at the performances that Chelsea have pulled in over Tuchel since he came in January, and we're talking about this potential fairy tale for Aguero and getting the winning goal, and Mo's even said if there's quite a few goals scored and he might get a little run out for the last 10 or 15 minutes if City are cruising. But based on the numbers for both teams in terms of defence, it's unlikely that there is going to be a flood of goals. John Stones and Ruben Diaz have formed this fantastic partnership for City. 13 clean sheets in the 20 games that they've completed, a full 90 together, just 8 goals let in. And then Chelsea, on the other hand, it has notably improved under Tuchel, but Edouard Mendy's just one clean sheet away from the most ever clean sheets kept in a single Champions League season. That'd be a big record for him to break. And when you look at the two teams, they have a huge amount of attacking flair and potential to score goals, but their respective defences are so good that it's hard to see a situation where we're seeing 4 or 5 goals scored in the final.
You know, for both teams, the defence has been really important this season. I think for Man City, a bit like Liverpool in the Premier League when they won it, it took a couple of years. You know, they had the attacking trio, but they needed Virgil van Dijk. You know, Man City, they have, you know, they have everyone, let's just say, but they needed Ruben Dias. You know, he was the final piece of that puzzle, and, you know, he's brought order to their defence, whether he's playing alongside John Stones, who's having arguably his best season at Man City so far, or if Aymeric Laporte comes in, you know, even after weeks, months out, it looks like he's never left. And then Chelsea, you know, defence was the biggest problem under Lampard. You had, well, you know, like I said, they had the strength in the attack, the players that they bought over the summer. You know, and it works to an extent. You know, if you can play what I think I'm alone in calling Vindaloo football, we'll score one more than you.
What a banger. You know, what a banger.
Shout out to Fat Les.
get that trademark now.
Yeah. But Chelsea weren't scoring. So the defence and last season, Kepa wasn't, you know, he had his moments where unfortunately he was at blame. And, you know, you say about Mendy's been brilliant. Do we say that just because, you know, he isn't Kepa and the standards are pretty low? Maybe a little bit, but you've also got to give Mendy the credit he deserves. He's got the best save percentage in the Champions League among those who have made, you know, 10 or more saves. So, you know, no one save wonder. He's made 30 saves from 33 shots on target. So of the 4 goals that Chelsea have conceded, he's only let in 3. One was a Karim Benzema, you know, wonder strike.
what Mendy has, so if I could just jump in, what Mendy has, I think that Kepa doesn't is also what Ruben Dias has that John Stones and Laporte doesn't, is that I think he's a communicator. I think he's very organised. And I think that is so important. We did an interview, Jake Wentworthville did an interview with Jose Font where he talked about him. And obviously Jose Font has basically mentored the two best centre-backs in the Premier League. The most recent ones, Virgil van Dijk and Ruben Dias. And he said that what defines them, what they share is communication. Their concentration is very good too. Concentration is very important, but they're communicating. They're always communicating, talking. Where's this? Where's that? Whenever you hear Rio Ferdinand talk about how great his Man United defences were, it's always about, we always communicate. Me and Van der Sar, me and Vidic, we're always talking. I don't know if it's what Mendy does. I assume that's what Mendy does because the effect he has on the Chelsea defence. I know that's what Ruben Dias does because Jose Font said so. And I assume that's what Mendy does. And I think that's what Thiago Silva brings as well a little bit when he comes in. I mean, because I think actually as a 1v1 defender, I think he's pretty ropey still. We saw West Brom have had great fun with him this season. But as a communicator, he's next level. And you look at Azpilicueta, he's always playing wing back, right back, centre back. Azpilicueta is, and we know he's a talker as well. I mean, you can hear him on the watching the games, you know. So communication is the key that I think has unlocked Chelsea's defensive power, and it's also definitely the key that's made City such a formidable defensive unit. And that a bit, and it's been quite ironic as well, because this is the one season where we can hear them communicate. Like normally, you know, the fan always drowns it out, and it's almost a case of maybe not having fans in there has helped City with this communication. Maybe if they couldn't hear John's Ruben Dias as clearly, maybe they would still be a bit of a mess. I mean, Chelsea, I don't know, but it's just funny how communication is such an underrated part, because you never think about like talking to your teammate. To use a Chelsea example, John Terry, right? When you think of, what made John Terry a great defender? Well, he was fantastic at tackling, fantastic in the air, and he could ping crossfield balls with his left foot, amazingly enough, like easily. What made John Terry a great defender was that he was yap, talking to everybody, telling everyone where to stand, and organising, which he learned from Ricardo Carvalho and Marcel Desailly. I mean, some of the best mentors you could ask for. So communication is what's so important to the defences. And I think Mendy, Ruben Dias, I think they've really brought that to the Blues.
Obviously, we've talked about the situation with Kante and Mahrez and how their careers have followed a similar path, Aguero's fairy tale. But an interesting subplot, Harry, that's coming in terms of the build-up to the final, which will have England fans licking their lips ahead of Euro 2020 this summer, is Phil Foden versus Mason Mount. And one of the best parallels you can draw between them, 2017 was a fantastic year for England at an underage level. Phil Foden was named Golden Ball winner as England won the Under-17 World Cup at the same time when Mason Mount was being named Golden Player as England won Under-19 at European level. So there's a lot of comparisons that have been drawn between the two of them so far this season. And you, by virtue of being a Chelsea fan, we're putting you on Team Mount. Mo, that means that you're going to have to be Team Foden. We're going to go with Mount first, because given the fact that he's ending the season so strongly, he's had to kind of put up with these rumours of the situation with Frank Lampard before he was sacked as his position as Chelsea boss. Would Thomas Tuchel rely on him as much? And he stepped up and he's proved to any Chelsea fans that potentially doubted him, and also to Tuchel, that he's up to the job. And you just look at some of his numbers. He's the only player in the team with over 60 tackles. He's the only player with over 60 chances created or 60 shots in the Premier League this season. He's all action and he just looks determined to prove a bit of a point.
Yeah, I think those that have followed Mount's career, especially Chelsea fans, because they've got that added interest, will have seen him, you know, thrive on loan at Vitesse. I know Vitesse gets a lot of stick for the connection with Chelsea, but he was brilliant there at Derby County in the Championship. And, you know, I think it was that season with Derby though that kind of counted against him, because I think that was where the Oh, Lampard's son came in. Chelsea fans the season before had you know, called Jorginho Maurizio Sarri's son because of how he used him at Napoli, and there seemed to be almost a stubbornness to play Jorginho no matter what the game required. And there was a time where, particularly more last season, where Lampard looked to be, you know, trying to put Mount wherever he could in the team. And so people thought that that was favouritism. But for me, personally, that was more because you need Mount in your team. So you know, because of what he can bring. You know, we've said the stats. He is, you know, fairly good in attack. You know, he's not quite there yet. I think people want him to be the next Frank Lampard. He's not got those goals. And I think his assists have been hampered slightly by the fact that, you know, he plays deep sometimes. He's played on the wing where he can't get into the game as much. And his defensive responsibilities sometimes, he's just there to, you know, either track back or press really high. So goal scoring is not his main aim. But I think that's what makes Mount so good, that you can play him wherever. And, you know, even when Southgate started playing Mount, there was still, you know, Lampard's son, Southgate's son. You can't really call him Thomas Tuchel's son. You know, I think it's just finally now with Tuchel that other fans outside of Chelsea and those who really, you know, watch Chelsea games.
I was a huge, not huge, but I was a sizable, mid-size, you know, reasonably sized Mount critic. Just because when I watch him, it wasn't so much that I didn't appreciate that he had talent. It was just the fact that I always watch him. I was like, he runs around loads, and is that why Lampard always starts him? And then what dawned on me as Tuchel stuck over was that he ran around a lot because that was the chaos of Lampard's team. There was no organisation in that side. So literally applying energy, which is what he did, was the best way to get that team going. And now you look at him under Tuchel. The comparison to him, I think, is not Lampard. It's not Gerrard. It's Deco. I think that's the most player he most reminds me of, because he can dribble with the ball surprisingly well. You look at him thinking he's not much. He just glides past people. He made a fool out of Fernandinho in the FA Cup semi repeatedly. Put Toni Kroos on the ground a couple of times in Champions League. So he can dribble with the ball. He defends very well. He can score goals, but he's not a goal scorer. He's not going to score like 50 goals, no, 20 goals, 30 goals like Lampard does. He can score goals. He can create goals. He's good at set pieces. And this is the thing we need to start doing with English players more, is comparing them to people that aren't English, because this current generation of English talent we've got coming through, and again, this segues nicely into Foden, is the fact that they're not, they're so much more technical and technically talented and tactically aware than almost any generation that's come before them in terms of understanding how the game is played. Like a lot of English players, there was always the joke about English players, pace and power, aggression, loads of intensity, but not necessarily tactically understandings, not so much, right? That was the sort of stereotype that English players had fallen into, especially midfielders, Gerrard, Lampard, great examples. But, you know, this new generation of players, man, they're different gravy. They're completely different. And I think that Mount genuinely reminds me of Deco. And I just think he's impressed me so much. I was a critic. I am now a full believer. Starting for England, starting for Chelsea, Mason Mount, very good.
We've kind of put you down as de facto Team Foden as well, Mo, because obviously Harry with his Chelsea connections is going to back Mount, and the performances that he's had this season, you can see where that comes from. But there's arguably no better example of that point that you mentioned about English players being criticised for a lack of technique over the years. The antithesis to that is Phil Foden. Pep Guardiola obviously resisted these calls to send him out on loan and toughen him up and get some experience, etc. And that's borne fruit in his performances this season, because he's been absolutely central to everything they've done in winning the Premier League title and now reaching a Champions League final. And Guardiola's so good in these situations at making these decisions. He won't be pressurised into, as we say, sending a player out on loan or doing something different with him. And one of the best examples of that with Foden is that no player has scored more goals under the age of 21 for Pep Guardiola than some fella called Lionel Messi.
I mean, you know, what you mean? Foden has beaten Messi's record, you mean, under Guardiola?
Oh, he's level with him.
I mean, there you go. Anytime you're level with Messi, that, you know, you've done something very impressive. Foden is a great example of what I meant by English players of different gravy now. Like he, you know, the big joke was the players like, he's Phil from Stockport after the semi-final win. It was like, oh, he's Phil from Stockport. And it's just like, yeah, okay, all right, calm down. But yeah, he is Phil from Stockport, and he's very, very talented. He's very skillful, and they brought him along at the exact right moment. And it's amazing, because obviously everyone doubted Guardiola, and Guardiola was like, look, just shut up. Foden's very good. Relax, relax, relax. Trust me. And yeah, you'd think the guy that turned Lionel Messi into the greatest player of all time, you'd think, let's maybe just trust him with Phil Foden. But, you know, no, you know, everyone knows better. But anyway, so he's finally, he brought him through at the exact right moment because Foden has had time to develop physically, had time to develop mentally, mature. Tactically, he's now got a better understanding. So he's come through exactly the right moment and he's been flying. I mean, he's not played that much. He's played 1,400 minutes, give or take, in the Premier League, which is not that often. But in the Champions League, this is where it's interesting. With the exception of the first game, where he only played 20 minutes at the end as a sub, he's started every other game in the Champions League this season, and he's played at least 69 minutes, played 90 minutes a whole bunch of times. And, you know, so he's become, I mentioned earlier, poor Raheem Sterling forced that 11, and, Foden is one of the two people that's done that. Riyad Mahrez is the other. Riyad Mahrez is 30. Phil Foden is 20. Foden is just, he's so good. It's like, obviously just, individually to watch him, right? He's great. He dribbles, he's quick, he's got pace, he runs in behind. He does almost everything you'd want a winger to do, really. And you see what he does, and it's like, okay. But then you think about it as well, tactically, how important he is. City don't play with a striker this season, and part of the reason why they're not do that is, especially in Europe, is because Phil Foden is so goddamn good. Like, he's your goal threat. Okay, when the striker, you need a midfielder that's going to run in behind, the way Pedro used it for Barcelona, for instance, right, when they play false nine. He does that, what Pedro did, what David Villa did. He makes those diagonal runs into space. He pushes, stretches teams out. He provides a genuine option. When he plays left wing, he can go outside on his left foot and cross the ball. The old Leroy Sané cutback, he's great at those. There's almost nothing he can't do. Like, he was the decisive figure in the semi, in the quarterfinal whenever Dortmund scored a goal in each leg, right? 90th minute match winner or something in the first leg, it was, you know, and then in the second leg, I mean, he should have also been almost as decisive as Mahrez in the second leg. He missed those two chances, one in each leg. 3 months ago, the calls for Phil Foden to start for England either didn't exist or were completely stupid. They were like, are you mad? What's wrong with, no, relax. Now, if he doesn't start for England, you're almost thinking, what's wrong with Southgate? 3 months, he's shot out of a cannon. He's come out of nowhere. And in 2021, really, it's just, you know, mind-blowing. I can't even speak. That's how good he is.
And the markets think that it's pretty tight between them. When we look ahead to Euro 2020, as you say, they're both expected to be in Gareth Southgate's squad. And according to William Hill odds, Phil Foden is 5-1 to win the Euro 2020 Young Player of the Tournament, and Mason Mount just behind him at 6-1 alongside Chelsea teammate Kai Havertz. For the overall player of the tournament, Phil comes in at 20-1. Mason Mount's a bit further back at 33-1, but there's still a running Chelsea link. Romelu Lukaku 20-1 and Eden Hazard at 25-1. Right, predictions, the tough one. Harry, we're going to go to you first, the Chelsea angle. Tuchel does seem to have a little bit of an edge over Pep. Based on the last two games, Premier League, FA Cup semi-final, he ended the quadruple dream, the quadruple, I'm catching your speech disorder there, Mo. He does look to have a little advantage over him, but there's so much pressure on Pep to win the Champions League that Tuchel can kind of operate on the side of that amount of pressure ahead of the final.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, Tuchel has somehow got Pep's number. So, well, certainly in the last two games. You know, Chelsea, something that we haven't seen in the past few matches, not against City. Chelsea took their chances against Man City, both in the FA Cup semi-final and in the Premier League game. You know, everyone for the Premier League game certainly obviously talks about Aguero and that Panenka, which, you know, allowed Chelsea to then get back into the game and take their chances. I do also think, though, that Man City will probably be more buoyed by form in recent weeks, by the fact that they are Premier League champions. I mean, Chelsea, just looking at the game against Arsenal and the FA Cup final against Leicester, they're, you know, that Tuchel long-term new manager bounces has kind of hit a slump. You know, it's all about how Chelsea now get over this. You know, we've seen two games where they've struggled to score against a team that can defend. I know, obviously, Man City won't set up to defend. They'll be more open than Arsenal and Leicester were. But I think it'll be a real big ask for Chelsea's attack to, you know, make it third, you know, three in a row. So I've probably got my pessimist hat on a little bit, but I do see Man City taking their chances and edging it.
And Mo, looking at City, obviously you mentioned Guardiola, the entire project that he's been involved in at City has been built almost towards this one night in Portugal where he almost has to win it because he's built his reputation on, I will win the Champions League for Manchester City. We mentioned Aguero's famous quote at the start of the podcast about him not wanting to leave the club until he'd won the Champions League. But Chelsea have proved to be the fly in the ointment for them in the last few weeks. When everything seemed to just be going absolutely flawlessly, Chelsea have stopped them in their tracks, beat them in the Premier League to disrupt the kind of feel-good vibe around winning the title, and then obviously knocked them out of the FA Cup. Do you think that is going to follow the pattern in the final, or do you think just all that pressure being on Pep will be enough to get them over the line?
There's two competing things here. The first thing is that, obviously, yes, Tuchel's had Guardiola's number in the past couple of games for Man City, where his team has sat deep. They're frustrated. City have not taken their chances, and then Chelsea have counted. Although, again, in the semi-final, we tend to forget maybe that essentially Zach Steffen gave Chelsea a goal. And, you know, if he doesn't do that, and we've seen this again in the last couple of games for Chelsea, if teams don't make mistakes, like one thing Tuchel's done quite cleverly, really, because absent the fact that none of his players really look like they want to score goals, apart from Mason Mount, and Pulisic sometimes, what he's done is he's built a team that presses really well, so organised that basically they force you into a sense of, you make a mistake, right? Every, like three, four, five games in a row, Chelsea's opponent would make a mistake. Chelsea would score a goal from that. And once they're 1-0 up, good luck, right? They're going to shut you down and that's it. It's over. What we've seen in the last couple of games against Arsenal and Leicester is teams that set up to not make that mistake. And they were very defensive as a result. And Chelsea didn't really necessarily have the ingenuity to break them down because they haven't really managed to integrate Hakim Ziyech into their system for some whatever reason. He's not really been that good this season. He's had his moments, but he's the guy that should be there to unlock these defences, right? And he's not really settled, and Werner's useless against low block. Havertz hasn't really settled. They need another season of cooking. You know, they're underdone in attack. The players are all there. The talent is all there. They just need another season of time together, right? But that's going to be a problem. So if Chelsea show up and Chelsea nick a goal, Chelsea force a mistake from Man City, you can see them doing it. But Pep Guardiola has played in 15 or 14 one-off finals. It's not Super Cups, like one-off cup finals. He's only lost once. He's won 14 of them. The only team to beat him was Jose Mourinho's Real Madrid, the most expensive team, well, at the time, the most expensively assembled team ever. Cristiano Ronaldo, Karim Benzema, Angel Di Maria, Xabi Alonso, Kaká, I think he came off the bench in that game. Pepe, Sergio Ramos, Marcelo. This is like murderer's row of big game players, you know. That Real Madrid final, Copa del Rey final, 1-0 after extra time. And it's a world-class header from Cristiano Ronaldo that won the game. Guardiola wins these games, man. He wins these games. He wins them. And it's not maybe not always pretty, but he wins these one-off finals. He knows how to do it. Sarri came very close. Took him to penalties, remember? Sarri did very well in the League Cup final. It's very hard to beat Pep in these games. I don't think Chelsea, they have the talent to do it, but the way they've been playing lately, I don't see any of their forwards stepping up to deliver in the big game. I don't see it happening. I think Mount will be very good, but I think they'll somehow miss chances. Timo Werner is obviously born to miss these chances. You can see him missing one from like 12 yards out, can't you? I think City win it 1-0.
I'm going to make it 3-3. All the signs just seem to be pointing between him finally getting his hands on the Champions League as Manchester City boss. Guys, we're going to call it there for part one and take a quick break. In part two, we're going to be looking ahead to the Europa League final. Manchester United up against Villarreal. Two managers in Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Unai Emery desperately in need of a trophy. And we're going to also be chatting to Dr. Rajpal Bra. He's going to be talking about Harry Maguire's injury and the likeliness of the England international being fit in time for the final. We'll catch you in a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Champions League and Europa League preview podcast. This special episode is brought to you by our sponsors, William Hill. We've already touched on the Champions League final and all the pressure surrounding Pep Guardiola ahead of a big, big night in Portugal. We're flicking our attention over to the Europa League now. Manchester United up against Villarreal. Mo, we'll start with you on this. Raj, we're joined by you to look at Harry Maguire's injury and then preview United's situation going into the final. But United have been quite solid in the Europa League this season, Mo, and quite an impressive record in 2021. They've not lost a Premier League game, having had a Thursday night and then playing on the Sunday. So there does seem to be a bit more steel in the team, reacting to European football and then the demands of turning that over 72 hours later and playing in the Premier League. But ultimately, it does all come down to this. There's no cup competitions left. The race for top four is essentially over. It all comes down to whether Solskjaer can cope with the pressure of a big final. He knows, United fans know, that he wants that first trophy as United manager. And there's the potential for the first European trophy for them since 2017 when they won it under Jose Mourinho. All the pressure is on United and Solskjaer and very little of it on Villarreal.
Yeah, it's a weird lopsided final in that way in terms of expectation. No one thinks Villarreal are going to do anything, which is weird because they've got Mr. Europa League as their manager. But with United, they've done really well to get this far and they've got a really high-powered attack, right? Like a really high-powered attack. Edison Cavani, phenomenal in the semi-final against Roma. They're really, really impressive. The midfield is kind of ropey. It's kind of like, kind of whatever. Like it's a bit, they're workers. They're hard workers, Scott McTominay, Fred. They're not exceptional, for instance. But that's generally been enough this season because the attack has been so good and the defence has been so good with Wan-Bissaka, with Harry Maguire, with David De Gea and Dean Henderson. The big thing is Harry Maguire is not going to play the final. So that's going to condition a lot of, can United rely on their defence if Maguire isn't there? Now, I think Twanzebe should be given the shot, the start, alongside Victor Lindelof. Let's see if it's him or it's Eric Bailly. I mean, we'll see. That's going to condition a lot of it. But, you know, United definitely need this win. They need a trophy under Solskjaer because they've made so much progress since they signed Bruno Fernandes, right? The Bruno Fernandes era, you know, 2020 to now. They've made all this, but they've become a legitimate side again. They're a genuine threat. They're second in the league, comfortably second. They've been really good to great at times this season. They've had moments where they've not looked very good as well, but they've been really generally pretty impressive. But all of that progress, as Spurs will attest to, means nothing if you don't win a trophy. You can progress up the league all you want, up the coefficients all you want. If you don't win anything, what does it even matter? I mean, United fans do not need to be told about the virtues of winning trophies. So Solskjaer really needs this. On the flip side, Unai Emery, I mean, he's a great coach and he's done really, really well with Villarreal. You know, it would be nice for him to win it, to obviously, because he just wins this thing all the time. That's what he does. But at the same time, I don't know if he necessarily needs it. Like, only Arsenal fans really thought any less of him after he failed with Arsenal. Everyone else sort of understood, Arsenal are kind of a mess, bro. Everyone fails there. Don't worry about it. You know, whereas, yeah, I think it's the narrative of Ole versus Emery is like, it's tricky, but I think United need it more than Villarreal do. I think Villarreal would be lovely, it'd be wonderful, be unexpected, but United need to win this game, man.
Raj, we'll look at Villarreal in just a second, but as Mo said, you look at Solskjaer and the potential of this narrative of him up against Emery in the final is obviously a bit of a subplot to the game itself, but you look through that United team and this crop that Solskjaer has developed, particularly in the last 12 to 18 months, in terms of a major trophy, a lot of them haven't won it. This, for some of them, will be their first major final and trying to make an impact. A lot of them are obviously going to go away then on international duty for the European Championships and the Copa America this summer. So this is an opportunity for players who either haven't played in a final for United or haven't won a trophy at United to feel what it is like to go into that. And mentally, that's going to be a bit of a question mark on certain players before the game.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, pressure does interesting things, right? It typically goes one of two ways. You can go the Barcelona-Liverpool route and capitulate, or you can rise up to the challenge and meet that pressure and become a better player, right? And like you said, though, the only way to know it is to go through it. And so being in this high pressure situation will help prepare some of these guys either for the Euros or just for the rest of their careers in general. But it's always interesting to see how players respond And even more interesting for United, if Maguire doesn't play, who is by and large their vocal captain, who's able to calm them down a bit, right? So that's another added factor to how players may react to pressure.
Mo, you called Unai Emery Mr. Europa League before, and I think that's pretty fair. He's the most successful manager in the history of the competition since it's been reformatted. But obviously that was during his time at Sevilla. At Arsenal, he tasted defeat in the final against Chelsea. But given the fact that he has this record in the competition of when it really counts, he wins, that will be something that will count against Solskjaer because he hasn't won a major final with United. And Emre, Villarreal, this is their first ever major final. They'll be happy to be in United's shadow in the build-up because they know, without doing them down, but they know that they're happy to be there, they're happy to have qualified for a major final. Whereas Manchester United, it's demanded that not only you qualify for major finals, that you actually go on and win them.
Oh, look, man, Villarreal, the town Villarreal, is the size of Macclesfield, right? Let's not. This is not even in any way, shape, or form an equal fight. Man United are a Goliath, and Villarreal are a very much. I mean, they're phenomenal. They've got great European history. They've got great history of performance. But they are a David. The fact this is their first final, they've come close. They had their Champions League semi final against Arsenal 2006. Remember, Champions League quarter final against Arsenal. They've got Europa League semi finals before as well. They're a really, really proven, storied sort of European outfit. A great team in La Liga. They're well organized, but they're not even close. Like you said, absolutely correct. The expectation of United is you win trophies. Villarreal, it's like, look, compete. Do yourself proud. Compete. Try and win trophies, sure. But if you can't, no one's going to kill you for it, right? But, you know, now they've got Emery. They've got this really good team. They've pinched a couple of players off Valencia, Dani Parejo and Francis Coquelin, ex-Arsenal guy. They've got a good team, a team good enough to beat Man United, frankly. If we're being honest, right? Like, this is the thing, especially without Maguire, they've got a team that's definitely good enough to beat Man United. You know, with Parejo and Coquelin, I'm not even exaggerating, they've got a better midfield than Man United. Although I'm not including Bruno Fernandes as a midfielder there, that's why that is. But, you know, like McTominay and Fred versus Parejo and Coquelin, if it comes down to a midfield battle, I know who I'm backing, right? And it ain't the United boys. So United need to make sure it doesn't become a midfield battle. They need to try and run in transition. But then if you open the game up, you open yourself to Gerard Moreno, 29 goals in 44 games this season. He's lethal. He's liquid. Carlos Bacca just got a hat-trick for Villarreal, and he's a backup. So, look, they're a potent team. Maybe they're not expected to win much, but they can absolutely win this game. They can absolutely hurt United. And if United aren't focused and not on their game, they're going to have to, like Raj says, it's going to be interesting to see how they deal with pressure. We've seen before Rashford deals with pressure pretty well, right? We've seen he can handle it. Cavani, we know, can handle pressure. We've seen him do it so many times for many, many clubs. But everyone else, we don't know in a final. I mean, Bruno Fernandes has been absolutely incredible. But again, we've not seen him in a final. Remember, Thierry Henry was one of the greatest players of all time. But in finals, he was not very good. So we don't know if Bruno Fernandes is going to show up. Pogba, we've seen show up as well. Sorry, I should forget. I forgot Pogba, World Cup final. You know, so we know he can handle it just a bit. But, you know, there's a few guys that can handle it, but vast majority of them, Wan-Bissaka, very good. What about finals? Luke Shaw, same thing. David De Gea actually won this competition over a decade ago now with Atletico Madrid. I think it was 2009-10, I want to say. He won it when he was like 19. So, you know, he's been there, but that was almost so long ago. It's like you can't even count it, really. Like, he's a completely different player now to the one he was then. But there is a core of United players that know what it's like to handle the pressure. The others are going to be important because they have to match the level. And of course, the key thing, again, I come back to it, is the midfielders aren't any of the players that have proven they can handle pressure at the final. And that's where I'm really worried for United.
And Raj, as Mo said, when you look at the United team, that there is still a bit of a question mark over so many of them and their performances in finals. And then when you look through that spine of the Villarreal team, Pau Torres and Raul Albiol at the back, Albiol's been around the block. He's played in Serie A, La Liga. Pau Torres is one of the most highly rated defenders in Europe. Coquelin, very experienced. Dani Parejo has been around in La Liga for well over a decade. And then Moreno up top, who's on absolute fire and probably in pole position to be Spain's number nine at the European Championships this summer. So there's plenty for United to be maybe not fearful of, but certainly wary of. Given the fact that they have those players running right the way through the middle of the team, there's the real scope to cause United plenty of problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we saw in that second leg, even versus Arsenal, which was a high pressure match in which if they give up one goal, they're out at least in the second half. And so they're also they've been tested more recently in that pressure than Manchester United have. And like you said, they responded quite well, especially I think Albiol, especially Coughlin, who made a couple, you could say potentially, you know, game saving tackles in the box. And so, you know, you just see the way they play, they're composed, especially I watch Albiol play. He's very tricky. He's very good at baiting the refs, but he understands how to let the pressure off his team. He understands the little nuances of how that affects the flow of the game and how sometimes getting the ball back, winning that possession, getting a free kick can just help settle the team, right? And so it's those little things throughout the game that can help you deal and mitigate some of that pressure so things don't then snowball into something far worse. And versus a Manchester United team, like Mo was talking about, who's trying to hit you quickly on the break, in transition, right? You need someone who can settle your team down in that regard.
Raj, looking at the Maguire situation in terms of his injury, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been quite straight when he's been asked about it by the media. He said he'll give Maguire every opportunity to be fit in time for the final, but ankle ligament damage suffered at the start of this month. He's missed the last two games, which, as Mo touched on before, they've lost and they've really struggled without him, not just as a defender, but as an organiser and as a leader. Just looking at the injury itself before we get into how United react if Maguire does miss out, what are the chances? Solskjaer, as I say, he's being relatively cagey, but the signs don't look good, but we know that Maguire will do anything he can to be fit in time to lead them out.
Yeah, it's tough. So he has what's called a high ankle sprain. Typically, that takes about 4 to 6 weeks. He has 17 days to get back from that. Now, there are protocols where you can come back quicker, but it comes with a much higher risk of re-injury. And that also doesn't mean that the player is going to be himself when it comes to movement, right? And then also we know that he has Euros coming up. What if he does get back and re-injure himself and he's out for that, which is obviously a risk factor. Also, what if he comes back and he's not himself during the game? Do you risk using an early sub on him and then completely kind of messing up your cohesion on the pitch as well, right? So there's so many factors here. I'm sure Maguire's going to want to come back. I'd be very surprised if it happens. I mean, I think it's almost like 70%, 75% chance he's not back for all those reasons.
I mean, yeah, this is the what you mentioned about using early sub is the key, right? We've seen this so many times where you rush a player back for a final and they're just not ready. And like Diego Costa in the 2014 Champions League final against Real Madrid is the big one, right? The one that we stands out to memory when he was their talisman at Atletico Madrid that season. They rushed him back from, I think it was a hamstring problem. He was not fit, played like 5 minutes. And then they had to go off. And it was just like, you wasted a sub. And then that sub would have won them the game because then they could have brought on Adrian later in the game for David Villa, who was exhausted. And they could have better counter-attacked and they wouldn't have been so defensive and they wouldn't have conceded the corner that led to the equaliser, that led to them losing the final. So, you know, that was a dramatic example. But that's, you know, if you start Maguire and he's not good. And because he's not the most mobile anyway. Let's just put that out there. Yeah. Even when he's fit. Right, you start Maguire. Have you heard of Samuel Chukwueze? Right, if you watch this guy play, if Maguire's not on it, Chukwueze will just injure him again just by running past him. He'll just try and catch him, and he'll just hurt himself again. So Maguire has to be 110% fit for the final to play. I would argue against teams with Gerard Moreno and Samuel Chukwueze that has that kind of movement and emotion. And I don't think what Raja said. I don't think he can be 100% fit.
Mo, you said before that your pick will be Axel Tounsebi to slot in for him alongside Lindelof, but the likelihood is that Solskjaer will probably go for Eric Bailly. Whoever comes in, it is going to be an issue because Maguire is so important. Will whoever comes in affect who plays in front of them? You said before it's likely to be Fred and McTominay, particularly without Maguire, to give that extra kind of shield of security because it's going to be an inexperienced defender alongside Lindelof. If he goes for Bailly, does it have to be Fred and McTominay, or can he roll the dice and maybe be a bit more progressive with his midfield in front?
Well, I mean, this is the one thing like Maguire, Bailly is by far the most athletic Man United defender. Well, him and Twanzebe are both quite athletic, but you could argue that maybe you could only start one of Pogba or Fred, and one of McTominay and Fred, sorry, and you could put Pogba deeper because maybe you have a more athletic defender to cover for it. But at the same time, I don't think you would do that necessarily, because I think at the same time you need that solid base, and Pogba has shown in the last few months that he's been really good pushing further forward from that more advanced role, playing deeper. It's a different kind of role you're asking Pogba to do, and I think in big games especially, it's always kind of tricky because you're exposed to the press in that deep position. Pogba's not very press resistant. He's too tall for it, frankly. Like the only press resistant tall player in the world, I think, is Busquets. Everyone else, just you press them and they just kind of struggle a bit if they're really tall. And I just think you look at it and you're thinking Coquelin will just be all over him, right? If he plays in that deeper role, Coquelin just be hitting him constantly, pressing him as soon as he gets the ball. And then if Pogba doesn't have time and space on the ball in that deeper role, then what's the point of playing him there if he can't pick his passes? So you're better off playing Pogba more advanced. I think McTominay and Fred, I mean, it's the best of a bad situation, really, isn't it? Like, they're both workers. They're both hard workers. They can at least be trusted to sort of harry the Villarreal midfielders, but they're not going to be able to progress the ball very well. But I think the thing is, because United don't have a defensive midfielder really of note, a true defensive midfielder like a Declan Rice or a Wilfred Ndidi, they can't afford to take that more of a risk. Like Matic, you can't put him in that situation because, I mean, God, you know, that's such a risk, right? Well, he could theoretically do well if he suddenly rolls back the years and plays like he did in the semi-final. He played really well, but like, that's a risk, because if he doesn't roll back the years and have this amazing performance, you're opening yourself up to get absolutely hammered in there. And so it's a problem you're not going to have to solve. I think it's a problem that will be solved by the most pragmatic solution, which is just McTominay and Fred. I think the reason I say Twanzebe over Bailly, by the way, is because Twanzebe is better in the air than Bailly is. He's more reliable and more stable. Like he started off pretty ropey in that Leicester game, making a mistake in early on. But then after that early mistake, which led to the Leicester goal, he was brilliant. I mean, I know United lost that game because they played a whole second team, but he was really good. And I think what he has is a bit more of that leadership about him, a bit more of that stand up and take charge, put his body on the line, get in the way of crosses. And remember, the one thing is, Harry Maguire did not play Man United's victory in Paris this year. He didn't. When Man United beat PSG in Paris, Harry Maguire was injured. He didn't play. Axel Tuanzebe played. Axel Tuanzebe was amazing. Now, admittedly, that was a different kind of performance. That was a rear guard. He was in one of a back three, and it was like back to the wall sort of thing. But he was still, nevertheless, amazing. And United's record without Maguire is pretty, I mean, it's pretty bad, right? Like, I mean, they've won three games without him, but they've all been in the cups. They won in Paris without him. They beat Granada without him in the second leg of that game after winning the first leg. But if you watch that game, Granada should have scored at least once, probably more than once. Yangel Herrera missed a couple, hit the woodwork a couple of times. They missed some chances. Without Maguire, he was suspended in that game. United, you could see, you know, missed him. And then, obviously, also Maguire missed the Brighton game in the FA Cup. That doesn't really count, you know. But then the league, he obviously missed the last two league games against Leicester and against Liverpool, and United have sorely, sorely missed him in those games.
Yeah.
And so that's the big concern, is that, you know, I mean, obviously, yeah, you can do what you want in midfield, but it's just having missing Maguire's leadership at the back is going to open things up so much for Moreno and Chukwueze. You can't rush. It's a catch-22 for Solskjaer. You can't rush him back because, as I said, as Raj said, you know, he's not going to have his full range of mobility. Yeah, he's not going to be ready. Yeah. But then also without him, it's still, you're hoping and praying that Bailly or Twanzebe, whoever it is, can hold on.
Looking ahead, predictions-wise, Raj, the key variables from both sides. Solskjaer is the first Man United player to win a European trophy and then lead the club into a final, up against, as Mo said, Mr. Europa League in Emre, who doesn't have some of the stars in his team that Solskjaer has at his disposal at United. And obviously, as we said, Villarreal, this is their first final. They're two very different situations. You've got Solskjaer, who's an absolute novice as a manager in these finals. Emre, who's full of experience. United, you would say, individually have better players, but Villarreal seem to have maybe a better unit, and United are more than likely going to be without Harry Maguire. Which do you think is going to be the decisive factor in terms of how this tips and who's going to win it?
I think the missing Maguire is going to be massive for them, just because of what we talked about. He's the organizer, and this is a high-stress game. You're being asked a lot of questions already. Now you don't have one of your main guys who can help solve those questions for your entire team. And you know Emery's going to have, you know, his boys ready to go. He always produces good games in the Europa League. And so I think that will be the deciding factor. You know, I actually lean Villarreal for that reason, almost a 2-1 game to them. And the big X factor with Manchester United is, to me, is always Bruno, because he's been so good. He can change a game with his ability to, whether it's to distribute, right? He's just been great. So he can completely turn a game on one play, and that can change a final. It can change a game. So, but obviously Emery knows that. So it's how do you take him out of the game is the question.
Mo, yourself, you've kind of put the case forward for United and then taken it away and then put it back forward again. And heading into a big final, it is obviously tense. And yeah. Solskjaer, as you mentioned, in terms of experience as a manager in finals, he doesn't have it. He has it as a player. He's part of arguably the most famous moment in the history of Manchester United in European competition. But there is a few question marks. Maguire, you know, we've talked about him and the likelihood that he's probably going to miss out. Are you still confident that just that star quality, the likes of Bruno Fernandes, Marcus Rashford, will have enough to win it for United?
Yes, just about. Just about. Because I think as good as Unai Emery is, and I think Manu Trigueros and Coquelin will press Pogba and Bruno Fernandes like crazy and try and deny them the ball. I don't think he'll quite go full Bielsa and have someone man-mark Bruno, but like it's not a bad idea. I mean, he's got 28 goals this season, joint most ever for a Premier League player in all competitions. He could have broken the record by the time the final rolls around, to be honest. He's amazing. He has been incredible. He is the go man for Man United in midfield. But the reason I give United the edge is not Bruno, because I think Vieira have an answer for that. It's not Pogba even. I think it's Edinson Cavani. I think that's the difference, because okay, look, Mason Greenwood's very talented, a great sharpshooter, but he's also 19 years old. He's 20 years old, very young, inexperienced. Marcus Rashford is utterly incredible and phenomenally clutch, but he's also carrying about 6 different injuries. He hasn't played without pain for 2 years. I think he just needs like 2 months of just solid rest. Just leave him alone on a beach somewhere to chill. They're not going to happen. I don't know how fit he's going to be. He's carrying so many injuries. Cavani is utterly world-class. Probably can't go for a whole season anymore because of his age. But look at him in the semifinals, like 4 goals and 3 assists over the 2 legs against Roma. He's devastatingly good. He's so intelligent with his movement. He's so sharp when he gets the chances to score goals. He can take different kinds of finishes, left foot, right foot in the air. He can run in behind. He can attack the ball in the air. He can come short. And I just think that's going to be the difference. A genuine world-class striker. Now, I mean, Moreno's playing very well. Rashford's playing very well. Bruno Fernandes is playing very well. Edinson Cavani is a world-class striker. One of literally the 5 best strikers in the world the last 10 years. He's a bit older now. But there's still the quality is still there. And I think he's going to be the difference. I think ultimately it'll be like a cross, whatever it is, and he'll be the decisive factor. I think United will win 3-1. I think it'll be 2-1 for most of the game, and then they'll probably nick one right at the end to make it seem more comfortable than it actually was. But I think United will win 2-1, and I think Cavani will score at least once, probably twice.
Okay, I'm going to go with Raj. I can see Villarreal just nicking it. And I think the thing with Emery in terms of the Sevilla finals that he won, I think 50 to 70 minutes is always such a key portion of any final. And I think when Sevilla did win those games, that was when they won it, because they never panicked, and Emery won't panic, even though he knows Villarreal don't have the experience that Sevilla do. He won't. Even if Villarreal are behind, he'll back his players to come good. And I just think if the situation is reversed on United and they start to feel the pressure because the expectation is on them, they might just start to crack a little bit. Mo, I'm sorry, but that's just the way I'm going.
No. I can see your point. And of course, the one downside to starting Cavani, it's not really a downside, but it's that all your eggs are on the pitch, or all your best players are already on the pitch, right? Greenwood will be off the bench, actually. If he starts Cavani, Rashford, Pogba, Fernandes, Fred and McTominay. Yeah, Greenwood will be on the bench to come off the bench, maybe. So maybe there'll be a little bit of hope for a game changer. But yes, obviously, Solskjaer, the main manager, is not going to necessarily... he can't read a game like Emery. Emery's a genius at reading games, makes adjustments all the time, really, really good. Like you said, he always adjusts very well. He beat Liverpool in a Europa League final with a backup right-back scoring twice. I mean, you know, what more can you say about a man who does that? He's special, but I just think... I think ultimately United will have literally just got too much firepower for him. Villarreal will suffer. But at the same time, Samu Chukwueze up against Luke Shaw's been very good this season, but Samu Chukwueze running at Victor Lindelof, just yeah, that's going to be
fun. It's a terrifying thought. Okay, I think that seems like the perfect point to end it on. Mo's silence and his worrying about Victor Lindelof. Mo, Raj, thanks so much for your time.
No worries. Cheers.
That's it for the Squawker Talker Champions League Europa League preview podcast. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again very, very soon.